A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hey everybody, Meg Riley here in warm, melting Minneapolis, and we have another episode of The View. It's our monthly time to talk to folks from Black Lives of UU. But first, let's have our regulars introduce themselves. Joanna?
Hi, I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Aisha Hauser in Seattle, Washington.
And I'm Michael Tino here in Peekskill, New York. And I want to apologize to our guests and my co-hosts. I'm going to be disappearing to go to an interfaith organizing meeting.
And hi, this is Terry Bernor. I'll be hiding behind the chalice doing tech support for y'all tonight. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota.
It's been a long day already, Terry, huh? You think it's tonight already. Terry's trying to ramp up our professionalism a little bit and get our sound and video better. So we're very grateful to her for that. Well, I think a lot of our minds are on the next few days, as many folks are getting revved up for those. And yet I think we're also all cognizant of the fact that we're looking at probably the rest of our lives for struggle. So I'm really curious with Black Lives of UU, how you're thinking about long-term resistance and struggle. And welcome, wait, let me just welcome you first. Sorry, I didn't even welcome you. Leslie Mack is here. I think you're still in Michigan, right? You're at home?
I am. I leave right from this appearance to head to the airport, to head to DC to join Lena in Washington a couple of days ahead of the Women's March. So yeah, I'm here in Michigan.
And Lena K. Gardner, who's been in DC all week, right, Lena?
Yeah, I took a side trip to New York to visit some friends for the MLK holiday. But other than that, I've been in DC working from the Standing on the Side of Love office here at the Impact Hub.
Great. And you did a fabulous interview that many of us listened to. It's wonderful to have Blue featured, even if they got it a little bit wrong about what it is.
A little bit wrong. Yeah.
You did your best. I heard you trying to correct course. You know, you did your best.
Well, I also, what they didn't play was that was a recorded interview. And when Lulu first said it, I said, no, we're called the Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism and we're not a BLM group. So please don't say that. So she re-recorded it, but she didn't like the way it sounded. She was like, that's just a lot to say. And I was like, but we're not a BLM group. Like, so. At any rate, then they just decided to go with the other one. I was like, well,
that's
all right.
Sounding a lot like the news these days. Oh, let's just say what we want to say. Why don't we? We will talk about the weekend and Blue's involvement with that. But I am really interested in the long term. I think many of us are really reconsidering our lives in good ways, I think. And I'm really curious what you're thinking about as you move into the coming months and years.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me personally, and I think kind of movement-wide, there has been this shift happening for a long time, you know, to move from an educational place to one of more, not necessarily direct action, but action generally speaking. So I anticipate more of that to go on. But I think it's really important to start framing the work in terms of some long-term goals, because this is not something that we're going to be able to, you know, have a checklist and mark it off and we did our job and then we go home and it's over. You know, we need to start building with long-term strategy in mind and long-term sustainability in mind, which is really the most critical thing I think that needs to change. We've really been operating from both the idea of scarcity and then secondarily this idea that this was going to be some temporary work that needed short-term funding, short-term support, and then we'd be able to move on to the next thing. If the election of who I have been referring to as Toupee Fiasco doesn't you know, leads to nothing else good, it would be this notion that we understand that sustainability has to be built into all of our movement strategy, all of the planning that we do, all the things that we want to come together and achieve. So that for me, that's the big thing, is to really have a push for sustainability and what that looks like in terms of support for activists, support for organizers, support for everybody that's trying to do this work. So that's a big thing for me in terms of developing some long haul work and strategies together.
I think to that end too, something I've really been thinking about and interested in is how do we work on working together and unifying, but not in a way that means blanketing over people's real concerns around when privilege shows up in the room or when people's concerns are being lifted up that are about class or about being cisgender or transgender. And how do we really work through things like that with each other, and how do we start to really help each other out in new ways and ways that we might not have thought about before? And like an example of this, these pink pussy hats that people are making and are really wild about. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about them, a lot of excitement. And then there's been some criticisms, especially out of the trans community, about the notions of gender essentialism that they're buying into and some different ideas. And like, what is our capacity to be open to those criticisms and still work together and move through them and still do the work that needs to be done ahead. And then absolutely, I think resilience is right. I think, you know, we've been running in sort of a campaign style cycle, but you can't keep that up at this pace. You know, I don't know one organizer who's not like, I'm so tired, I am worn down. Many of us are sick chronically. I've been sick for 3 months. You know, I know I can't stop and I don't want to stop, but there's got to be another way that is less detrimental to our health and well-being. And I think trying to find that way together is gonna be what needs to happen in the next coming months and years ahead.
You know, you can kind of watch the cycles, at least I can, among my white friends, of like when people wake up. Like Sandra Bland woke up a lot of women who were kind of asleep through some of the killing of men. And now I feel like there's this new crop of people who woke up, white people. And like I went to a local, you know, my local elected people had a thing and 150 people turned up, and like 100 of them had never gone to anything before and they just turned up. And I wonder about how we build a movement or whatever you want to call it, how we do this work to bring in this new energy. I'm concerned about all these folks going to the march and then going, there, we did that, and coming home again and feeling like, well, I said my piece. And so how do we build that kind of sustainability of more people stepping in and holding some of the load?
Well, I know lots of work is being done. You know, there's a really great teach-in that's happening at All Souls UU in DC after the march that is meant to kind of bridge that gap between showing up for something as you know, outwardly demonstrable as a march and doing real work when you get back to your own home communities, wherever those may be. So there are people that are working on those things and definitely looking to channel this energy into something different. You know, Lena and I were talking this morning just about this feeling we have, like I'm fine going to DC. There's lots of things happening around the march that I find really valuable. I don't know how much value I see in the march itself, you know, and that's just real. You know, it's not going to be for everyone. It's not going to speak to everybody, but you know, we have moments like this where we're able to capitalize on energy. We're able to capitalize on attention, and hopefully we're given the resources and opportunities to capitalize on those things. I think that's really where the difference becomes, you know, who are we giving up these platforms to? Who are we lifting up? Whose voices are we centering? Who are we giving the resources to reach these masses as they come together? And I think that's definitely been a pretty lively, you know, criticism of the march itself, which is, you know, how do you have, you know, these huge stars on a stage and still center those that are most marginalized at the same time? It's a fine line to work. And listen, you know, I love Linda, I love Carmen, I love Tamika. They're doing amazing work to try and really do what has not been attempted before, which is really to hold specifically white women accountable for their presence in spaces that are not meant to center them. And it's been very difficult for them. You know, I've spoken to each of them at least 3 times over the last 2 months, late night, 2 a.m. or later most of the time, you know, where, you know, they're just at their wit's end with, you know, the kind of micro and macro aggressions that they had to face to even get to this point, even as seasoned, as well respected, as nationally known as the three of them are. Their skills and their ability to do the work that they set out to do was still questioned at every turn. And so there's a lesson in that for me, which is that, you know, it looks great to be on TV and do all those things, but behind the scenes, we're still, you know, working against forces that are really meant to not hear us whatsoever. And that's true of all of us. So I think that's the lesson there, is to see when people go back, who's there to pick up those things, and who's funneling resources to those folks to make sure that they're being centered after the march is over.
Yeah. And I think there's also a push, like, locally to do what we can. I know myself and a lot of other, a handful of other clergy and other faith leaders and clergy made, you know, trainings, and we trained a little over 200 people before we left. We also, the big piece of that too was making sure we have a way to get back in contact with those folks after the march, and to, like you said, make really bring them deeper into movement and say, you know, it's good that you went to this march and that it, you know, got your attention, and now let's talk about, like, what the work looks like on the ground, you know, moving forward. And then we tried to translate that into a webinar I did last night with Caitlin Breedlove and Reverend Ashley Horan, and there was over 120 people on that webinar that we did last night, and then we're going to also do a debrief afterwards. And I think I'm hearing lots of echoes of that across the country, of what people are doing, of taking this opportunity to network locally, and bring new people in that haven't been brought in the same way. And I really feel like that's what's going to have to continue to happen. I think one of the things that, like, my heart is struggling with the most is that I want to be happy that people have been, you know, so-called awakened or brought into movement. But where I struggle is that many folks have been in this struggle for a long time, even, you know, certainly much longer than me or other, or like our contemporary movement. And, you know, we really have seen, like, our liberation tied up with and connected to people with less privileges, you know, with less privilege than us. And so now to see folks coming into it, who refuse to march, you know, in Black Lives Matter marches, because they feel like now suddenly this might affect them more personally. I think that's something that I'm fundamentally struggling with, like, in my own heart. Like, I can feel it. It's a darkness. I don't know what else to call it. Like, it's just with me. And I am really struggling with it because I want to be happy that people have woken up. But the truth of the matter is, some of these same people who are now so up in arms were not supportive, and that's to put it lightly, of, you know, when we were out in the streets as Black Lives Matter, fighting for Black folks, mostly poor Black folks in poor communities, right? And so for me, you know, that's just very difficult, and I don't have an answer. You know, I had breakfast with a friend this morning in DC who's actually works in the mayor's office in Minneapolis and is out here on a trip, and we connected, and one of the things, you know, she's finally like, I get it. And I'm like, that's hard for me. Like, you know, I don't know. I don't even have good language for it. But that's something I'm certainly encountering, even in the spaces when I was training other, you know, you use. And even on the webinar last night, you know, one of the things I talk about is tearing down power or structures of oppression, right? And how we need to tear those down. And, you know, some of you said, well, are we talking about burning all of society down? And, like, I loved Caitlin Breedlove reframed it and said, you know, it's about transformation. And I brought it back and I said, you know, it is about transformation, and that requires that some stuff be brought down. Like, you have to start to get comfortable with that, I think. And so it's fascinating to me to see folks coming into this and to try and create compassion and grace for that in my heart when for so long they were in many ways against us, right?
to that point, I've been having interesting conversations with women who are going to march in Seattle. And a couple of them said, well, I'm kind of worried. And I said, worried about what? And they, well, you know, we're going to be targets. I said, well, I've marched here with Black Lives Matter in Seattle and it's been fine. And, I've been to other marches here where we were being provocative, or at least can be more perceived that way. And then this march is supposed to be silent, most of it. I'm not sure how that's going to work out, but 3.5 miles of silence and then only the speakers until we get to the end. So I said, I'm not really worried. And I mean, sure, anything can happen. I'm not naive, but it just feels like, so it was an it felt like that. I'm like, that's what that is. It's like, oh, because you haven't really done this before, you're thinking, you know, the first march with, I mean, and I don't know, anything could happen, of course, but I've also seen that definitely. And thank you for naming that, Lena, because I'm like, I don't know what to do with you because exactly, you know, folks have been living with the reality of this for so long. And then people just waking up is, I mean, sometimes I've been annoyed by it and I don't feel good about it. It's like, I want to go just sit back and listen to the folks of color who've been doing this. How about that?
Go ahead. Yeah. And I think a lot of the times the thing that's most frustrating is the assumption of authority that comes along with people's awakening. And to me, that's where the darkness comes from. You know, if this was just a matter of, hey, I'm new, I'm a newbie, I don't know what I'm doing. That's stuff we deal with all the time, regardless of race, creed, color, whatever. We deal with new people. We deal with onboarding folks. We deal with bringing people into space. But the problem comes where authority is assumed, where there should be no authority whatsoever. You have no expertise. You have no experience. You have no education around these things. And yet you feel the need to say things like, I'm really worried, with absolutely no basis in reality, fact, or actual information. So I think a lot of that is where some of the negative feelings bubble up, at least for me, where I feel my hackles come up is where I hear, you know, general declarations or open, you know, just proclamations of taking over a space or assuming authority, or that your opinion means something super important just because you want to say it. Those are the things I think that people really need to be a little bit more mindful of. It's something we've been really trying to incorporate into a lot of the safety pin box tasks, which is really just like, there's kind of a four-step process we go through. So we have self-education, we have self-analysis, then we have introspection, which is a really critical piece before you take action, because you really have to like go back, analyze what you've learned, analyze how you relate to it, and then you'll be able to actually make a action that's not harmful to other people. And that piece is just really generally missing, especially when we're talking about white folks. It's really just non-existent.
I watch y'all, and I mean, both of you have been such champions of compassion and love. And I, as a white woman, am struggling with empathy right now. I mean, when I hear somebody say, you know, I hated Affordable Care Act until I got cancer, and then everyone's like, yay you. And I'm like, no, not yay you. What the hell? You had to get cancer yourself. Or I was against gay rights till my kid came out. Like, no, not. So it's, I think keeping that open-heartedness for me as a white woman is a challenge. And when I see all the ways that white people are turning to people of color to say, what should we do? No, I'll tell you what to do. You know, just the complexity. Leslie Mack, I think you, with the safety pin box, created a brilliant way to say, if you're going to lean on me, you're going to pay me for it, which at least is something that I can, in good conscience, refer white people to, right? But I'm curious how Blue is negotiating right now in, I mean, it, because so many of the Black folks who are Unitarian Universalists are in these home environments that are like this, right? Amanda from CLF is meeting with a covenant group and people are processing there, but are people talking to each other and supporting each other through this?
Yeah, I think we've been doing a lot of, especially in our closed Facebook group, a lot of discussions around this, a lot of support for each other around it, and just dealing with it. I mean, I think for Black UUs, what happens is we tend to isolate. You know, we really don't have a choice in terms of our faith connections, but to isolate in moments like this when we are easily bruised, and those that we interact with are ready to bruise us. And so we tend to become insular. And so in those moments, we talk to each other, we talk with each other. and just try and provide some support and some context for things. And I think it's hard. You know, we want to do this difficult work. You know, I talk all the time about, you know, if we can't move what you use, like, I don't know who we're going to be moving. And so that pull is very strong for all of us. You know, it's why we stay. It's why we continue to be in community. I can't tell you how many Black folks will say to Lena and I, like, why are you working with these people? Like, what are you doing? Like, why are you spending your time on this? You know, we hear it all of the time. So I don't even think white UUs realize that, like, that our Black peers look at us and say, like, why are you expending your talents and your energy on these people? We get it all the time. So, you know, that part of it is very real. I think what's great for Lena and I is that we really grounded Blue in support for Black UUs. And so we are able to channel our energies in that way very specifically and not really worry about that other stuff and really just tend to the needs of Black UUs as they come up. And so that's where we're, you know, collectively focused as a group.
Yeah. And I think for me, like, when I feel really overwhelmed by, you know, racial aggressions and trainings, or just overwhelmed really by feeling sort of suffocated by whiteness, I think I try to both focus in on Blue community, reach out, you know, I've gone Leslie before and like, I can't do it. You know, and also the other thing I try to do is really hold on to those white folks who are willing to do the work and have been in it with me and have shown up. And, you know, I think of like Michael Tino, who, you know, donated his air miles so I could get out here to DC, or like all of the countless ways that Meg, you have helped guidance and just love in Minneapolis. And I really try to hold on to that. And then I try to also hold on to, you know, in this work with the promise of this $5 million from the UUA, there are individuals working really hard with us to try and move through the challenges of making that happen. And these are challenges both logistical and concrete, and also, I think, like, at a very deep spiritual level of like, we want to do this and we want to be grounded in love. And how do we do that? Just trying to hold on to those things and focus on those things really has been helpful for me. I know I'm still, you know, honestly, I'm still like, am I actually going to march in the streets with all of these people? You know, and I'm just like really kind of torn about it. You know, and I will probably end up going to go, but it's, I think, you know, like Leslie said, it's right. Like, you get what you can from the experience. And then there's all of these actually other experiences built out around it that are actually, are what is most meaningful for me right now in this moment. And so that's what I'm holding on to, you know, excuse me, being able to be in DC for a few days before and after helps me be able to connect with other people and do different things that I wouldn't if I just came in, you know, right for the march and then left. And so, you know, really trying to focus in on those things, I think has been really helpful for me. And something that's also been helpful is really, you know, thinking about other, you know, groups of folks that are struggling with this, right? Like Latinx folks, Indigenous folks, being able to go to Standing Rock and then talk with some of my Indigenous friends around the connections and the intersections, it has really also given me a different sense of place in the world. And I know that sounds funny, but it's really helped me to understand myself as part of a bigger and interconnected struggle, which makes it not feel so alone and isolating, which it sometimes can feel like.
Yeah, for sure. Or, you know, Lena mentioned the $5 million support that the board has promised to us. And so we're working through the process of actually receiving those funds and that financial support, which is definitely a process. It's something a lot of us are involved in at different stages. There's a communications piece, there's obviously a logistical piece, and then there's an institutional one. And so for us, it's really important on all of those levels that we are very transparent with the folks at the UUA, so that this process is very different than what happened 50 years ago. And it's really something critical that we all need to be cognizant of as we go through this process, not just because we don't want history to repeat itself, which truthfully it does very very easily, right? But secondarily, because a lot of other faiths are really looking at this moment right now and seeing, you know, what are the UUs about to do? How are they in community with this Black group? What does it look like? How are they modeling? And it's going to be a really big deal. I've heard from so many other faith leaders that are like, wow, we're looking to see how this is going to work out and what's going to happen. And so to that end, of course, we have the convening coming up at the beginning of March. And I'm so excited about so many pieces of it. But one of the things I'm really excited about is that we're going to have at least two, up to four of the leadership from 1967, from BAC and BUUC. I don't know how they say those acronyms, so I'll just spell them for
Back
now.
Back and Buck,
I guess, that are going to be with us. And I was actually on the phone with a couple of them a couple of days ago, just talking through some different things. And it's really amazing to hear how similar their experience was up until this point. And then when I started talking to him about the things we're trying to do differently, they both were like, whoa, you know, that's so great. I'm so excited to hear that you're trying to go a different path around this. And that's also a lift up of the board's decision and their commitment to do things differently as well, not just ours. So I'm excited they're going to be with us and really give us some grounding in what came before, so that we can really have that internalized as we build what comes next. So folks can go to our website, blacklivesuu.com, and just click 2017 convening. Registration is open right now. Bunch of information is there, including the location, which is at the DoubleTree in New Orleans. And you can book your hotel room, you can register. We have lots of financial aid available for both housing and transportation. So definitely check all of that out. So we're very excited about it. It's going to be awesome.
I'm really excited about it too. Are you building the agenda for that the way that the Cleveland convening happened, or how are you doing that?
It's a little bit different because we have such a specific goal of leaving there with a greater understanding of what our work looks like next. So it's going to be a lot less workshop driven in terms of like information and teaching and things like that, and a lot more community building pieces. So we're going to have some plenary work, and then we're going to spend a lot of time really getting into the nitty gritty of what pastoral care looks like for Black UUs ideally. You know, what does financial support for Black UUs look like ideally? What do gatherings look like? How do we want to organize ourselves? You know, Blue started out as a very, as Lena mentioned, campaign or project-based work, and this is a very big transition to move into some long-term sustainable work. And, you know, we're all excited to do it. And at the same time, it's not for the 5, 6, or 7 of us to do alone, you know? So we're just psyched to get, honestly, I'm just excited to be just in a room with that many Black UUs, to be perfectly honest. So it's going to be dope.
It's very exciting. How many are you expecting? And are young adults going to be there? And, yeah, so and what we- about youth?
Yeah, we do. We have a robust youth and young adult plan in place. Luckily, we have Kenny Wiley on our team, who is well-versed in doing all that. And Elizabeth Gwen's been helping as well. We've had really tremendous support, so we're excited for that. Really, young adults are going to be with us. They need to be shaping this next future as well. It's certainly much more theirs than ours, so there won't be a separation there, but there will be youth specific content as well.
Do you feel like the, you know, Lena mentioned people being tired and sick and weary, and it almost feels like before anybody can focus on new stuff, you need massive, we all need massive healing, but especially the people who have been so out front and so vulnerable. I mean, Leslie Mack, I follow on Facebook some of the massive amounts of crap that gets shoveled at you for being public and visible. And I feel this need for, you know, massive healing, laying on of hands. What are you thinking in terms of how to support? I mean, it seems like one of the gifts of the convenings that I've seen only from the outside is massive attention to self-love and care.
Oh yeah, it's going to be very healing, a lot of self-care focus, and really a lot of theological focus. I think it's something that Black UUs have been starving for within our faith, is a theological grounding. And so there's going to be a lot of that from a multitude of different religious backgrounds, including from all over the African diaspora. So we're excited to just have this opportunity to really sit into our Blackness and our UU-ness all together. And it's going to be pretty amazing.
What you envision for that energy after the march, where that might lead?
it's tough to say. The thing is, let me say this plainly. I don't know any Black people that don't already have a plan post, pre, during, all around the march. So I don't think this march has any bearing on the work that we all have set out to do. So I'll say that. I don't think that there's a new plan based on being post-march. Now, for those that are just entering the work, I think that they need to develop a post plan. And I hate to keep coming back to Safety Pin Box, but, you know, Marissa wrote some amazing content this month about our theme is not my president. So it's all about really building resistance into your life. We talk about how you talk to kids about Trump. Are you really a safe place? You know, when you put that safety pin on and said you were safe, what does that mean? How do you assess what that looks like? And then building your own militia, right? Building a very tight emergency connections with people in your immediate vicinity so that when stuff goes left, you have people to call on. You know, Lena talks all the time about how difficult it is for people to try and build community during crisis. And so what everyone really needs to do when they leave the march is, especially if you're new to this work, is to make connections, as many as you can, be humble, listen to those that are experts in your area, and make those connections when there isn't a crisis point so that when something happens, you're ready and able to serve effectively and you're not trying to inject yourself in a moment where everybody really needs to be focused on other things.
The other thing I would add is I think there's also, it's astonishing to me the level of scarcity with which a lot of white UUs in particular, the frame that they live in, that they live with, the amount of what they think they can do or can't do and what they feel constrained by it's consistently surprising to me. You know, I'll never forget when I gave, you know, during our pledge drive, I think it was like 3 years ago, I got up in front of everybody at the church and actually said how much I made at the time. And it was like, I think it was like $30,000 at the time. This is before when I was still in school. And, finishing up graduate school and working, and people were just floored. And they were like, you make that little and you are still giving to the church. And I was like, well, of course, because this is my spiritual home and it's important to me. And, you know, somebody else, you know, she came up to me and was like, wow, I really was just caught off guard by that. And she was like, one, that you talked about how much money you made. Like, nobody really ever talks about that publicly. And second, just that you know, she said it in a loving but slightly condescending way, like, and you make nothing. And I was like, well, I do survive somehow. I don't know. But, you know, that's one thing that I think that UUs could really stand to learn from movement is taking a step back and thinking, what are the resources I actually do have? Because people have usually a profound amount more than any of us in movement, especially those of us who come from Black and Brown communities, which have been historically looted for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, I've really been, I think that that's really something, a sense of abundance and also a sense of like, let's go forward, even though we don't have every like I dotted and every T crossed, right? There's this tendency for UUs to like want to ask like all of these questions, even in planning the training for the, you know, before the march in Minneapolis. You know, I was in a room and people were like, but Lena, who is the target? And will, what if somebody is not going, but they want, you know, not going to the march, they're not going to St. Paul's march, but they want to come? And I was like, it wouldn't even occur to me to like think that that was a question that needed answering before going forward with the training, right? Like there's something very particular and peculiar about that, what you need to like have everything figured out before you move forward. And I think that that's, you know, Ashley Horan said it best last night. She said, right, in liberalism, it's bureaucracy that's going to kill the movements, not outright resistance. And I feel like this need to have every little minutiae thing figured out before you go forward is kind of a symptom of that. And so I really think that's something that a lot of UUs could learn from movement, is that a lot of times we are moving super fast and you have to be able to move that fast and be able to go forward with some ambiguity. I think that's just a part of the work. And so finding how we can ground ourselves spiritually in our beliefs around abundance and how can we let like love carry us through those moments of ambiguity of not knowing, instead of grilling who's ever at the head of the table for all of those answers, right? When a lot of it, like, we could come up with it together, or like, if you're that concerned about it, you could start, like, you know, your own subcommittee and figure it out, because we all love committees so much, as you use.
Well, so many Unitarian Universalists, I think, need to learn how to be in a space where their voice and their experience and their questions are not the center. You know, part of my job as a white man in this is to teach people that. So I'll shut up now.
That's hilarious. Yeah, and not just that they're not centered, but that they really, like, I go back to this authority piece again, because that's really where the crux of this comes in. Because those questions that Lena just mentioned, it wasn't just that they had them, right? It's that they thought that those questions had to be answered because they thought that they did. And that's where the problem comes in. You can have all the questions in your mind you want to. It's very natural. It's a human thing to occur. But, you know, just like you wouldn't interrupt a surgeon in the middle of surgery to tell them you think that they shouldn't use that scalpel, you sound ridiculous. And that's how you sound coming up to professional organizers, trying to tell them how to organize when this is the first time you've ever done any of this work. And yet, that still is what we are continually dealing with. So it's not just the centering piece, but it's this authority piece that really we need to continually work on, especially as you use, because we're usually white, wealthy, highly educated. Those three things lend you to have authority in almost any space that you're in by default, but not in this one. And that's really where the problem comes in.
That's so true. I have a perfect example of this, and I'll just share because I still feel the need to have some catharsis over it. That line of, like, that it's the need to address it right then. You know, at one of the trainings, I did the first part of the training, and then Jess Banks, who's an amazing organizer, activist in Minneapolis area, she was doing a bystander intervention training. So I was trying to set up her PowerPoint and make sure that, you know, that all the audio was working and that the computer was set up. And I could feel this white lady just, like, on the periphery. I actually don't know for sure if she was UU or not, but she came, you know, I could feel her, and I just looked at her and I said, you know, I can help you in 1 second. I'm just making sure that, you know, my presenter has everything she needs for the next part of the training. Now, in my experience, when someone tells you that, like, okay, you should back off, you should wait, you should, you know, understand that this white lady, she didn't even take a step back. She took a step forward. And then she actually said, like, well, I just think you should have read the principles of the march before you did this training. There are so many layers to that, to, like, dissect. My first gut reaction was, like, I'm going to punch you in your face. Obviously, I didn't do that. I often talk about, you know, years of rugby will do that to you. But, you know, I was like, this is ridiculous. Instead, I put, you know, I matched her fake passive aggressive Minnesota smile that she was wearing. And I said, you know, I did read the principles, and I will talk to you later because I need to set this up. And she got really offended and was like, you know, oh, well, you didn't have to be so rude. And I'm just like, how is it that I'm rude when you came up interrupting my work when I asked you not to like make all of these assumptions about what I did or didn't know? And like, it was just so many layers to that. And I think that's exactly right, Leslie. It's that, no, she had something so urgent that she needed to tell me right then. That's the type of stuff that, like, that does make me question if people are right around organizing with white UUs or not, you know.
And I'll say that those things happen to white leaders without the layer of racism on top of it. My favorite example, my partner is Kendrick, is an artist, and she once did an artist talk at a UU church, and a guy told her that a part of her painting that was orange should have been purple. And she was a kindergarten teacher for years, and she just smiled at him and said, sounds like you want to make a purple painting. And in my mind, when people do that kind of thing, that's what comes to me. Sounds like you want to make a purple painting. But the fatigue of watching the racism on top of the anti-authority stuff, that's just so relentless. Honestly, I watch in awe because I get so thin-skinned and tired of it, and I don't have that additional huge layer of questioning everything and the presumption of superiority about race. I have it about some other things, but I just really, I think the work is amazing. And what you said earlier about just because, I mean, I kind of feel this, no one said it quite in English, but like now that Trump's president, do we still have to deal with all the microaggressions? Because now we have this bigger problem, you know, like, so we're the good guys now. So by definition, because we're not Trump voters, we're good. Nobody's exactly said that, but are you feeling that too? Or is that, I'm feeling that from white people more since the election?
Well, I can tell you that I don't know any Black people that are feeling that way for a couple of reasons. One, because this was a white presidency, right? So white people in every demographic and configuration voted for this person. So there isn't this, there isn't a way to separate yourself from what has occurred and say that you're a good person, because this is your community. These are your neighbors, these are your sisters, these are your cousins, these are your coworkers. We are a very segregated society. So these are all the people that you deal with on a regular basis as a quote unquote progressive or liberal white person. What did you do to stop this from happening? The answer is not enough. And so there isn't a good and bad. This is where we are today. We're ended up here because nobody wanted to listen to Black trans women for the past, I don't know how many decades. And that's why we're in this position that we are right now. So to me, there isn't really any, you know, there's no kudos for not voting for Trump. I don't even understand what that even would mean. It's this notion of like, you should get kudos for being a decent human being, which I just don't give those out. Not for me anyways. I don't know if Lena has more to add.
No. I meant are more white people coming at you with that energy. I didn't expect Black people to be having that.
Yeah, I mean, if any white people know me, they know better than to say that stuff to me. So,
well, I think first we have to address that, you know, a lot of white youth have, you know, said that they're scared of me and Leslie. They're scared of us. We hear this in roundabout ways because we're just so direct, I think. And then there's lots of racialized things underneath that as well. So no, I don't think anybody's going to say that directly to our faces or show up with that. I think, you know, I was actually just talking with my Lyft driver in on the way here, and he was Black man in DC, and he said, you know, one of the first things he said is, why are you in DC? And I said, oh, I'm here for the march, you know, and we got that really clearly out of the way. Like, oh, you're, you know, he was like, if you're here for the inauguration, I'm gonna ask you to get out of my car. But then, you know, he said, the very next thing he said was, he's like, I'm just mad at all the white people. He's like, I'm mad at all of them. And I think that that sentiment is true too, you know, for me as well. And somebody also asked me like, oh, well, aren't you really excited to work with all these women who are going to the march? And I'm like, no, because it's a little bit like the same thing with the safety pin, right? Like I watched somebody on Facebook on somebody's wall. I think it was actually Ashley Horan who, she said, okay, all of the folks who said they're going to wear a safety pin, there was an attack on a Black trans woman. And she said, is this the type of thing that you're ready to intervene on? And, you know, this one white lady said, yes, I'm totally there. I would totally call the police. And I was like, that would be the absolute wrong thing to do, you know? And so in some ways, it's almost more dangerous to have these folks thinking that they're suddenly have done the work to think through issues of power and privilege and oppression at a very like internal level and interpersonal level and then systemic level, when just because you didn't vote for Trump, that doesn't mean that you sidestep all of that work or that you've done any of that work. That's just not what it means. And I think this is what MLK meant when he said liberal white people are the most dangerous. You know, so I think there are some folks out there with that mentality or that viewpoint that, well, at least I didn't vote for Trump. The reality is that it's almost like you're more dangerous to me. And that's, I think I said something like that when the safety pin stuff was all buzzing around. I'm like, if I see a safety pin on you, I'm running the other way, because I already know the white people in my corner who have done their work. I already know who I can call because they've been in community. They've been doing this work for years and we've struggled through. And like Leslie said, I lift up time and time again, you can't build community in a crisis situation because you have to have trust with people and people have to know that you're not going to hurt them. Or if you do unintentionally hurt them, which we all do as humans, that you are going to take responsibility for that. And you are going to make amends and you are going to rebuild that trust. You know, I know for a fact that if stuff goes awry, like Meg Riley is a white person that I can call on because we've been through it. I know that if she says something that is grounded in whiteness, you know, she's gonna say, shit, I maybe can't swear. You know, she's gonna be like, dang, I messed that up. And let's keep going. And I'm gonna work on it. Right. And so those are not the people, you know, wearing, just putting on a safety pin or just the fact that you didn't vote for Trump or even just coming to this march doesn't mean you have done that work. That's not what it means. And so I just think that that, you know, I think it's good if it's getting people to a place where they are willing to do that work. There are certainly more than enough people in the world willing to help them do that. I think Surge showing up for racial justice, you know, is starting to do that work. I think that there's a lot of folks, there's certainly Black and Brown organizers all over the country and Indigenous organizers who have been at this for a long time. And there's certainly that sentiment, but I certainly don't feel like, you know, I'm like, do you want a cookie? Because that's about all you can get for not voting for Trump in my book.
Well, there's people talk a lot to organizers about, oh, meet people where they are. But it seems like we never really hear the opposite, which is if you're one of the people that's stepping forward, first pause and take a look at where you are, you know, in all of this. Don't make that the responsibility of everyone else to meet you there.
Well, it goes back to decentering whiteness. And you use, because humility is sadly lacking in our theology, at least the way I've heard it expressed, we still continue to center whiteness. And that's what I hear. That's still happening, even in organizing work. It's just centering. It's like the authority piece. So how do, you know, we need, in terms of clergy, I would ask, do your own work of decentering authority and whiteness and bring humility into the discussion. Because in terms of organizing, POC, Black people, Black women, trans women are the authority, period, full stop.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, Aisha, because, you know, we talk all the time about the first revolution being within, and that's really what that's about. You know, UUs have a really uncomfortable tendency, at least uncomfortable for me as an organizer, to always want to look outside. You know, we'll get great support for a march to go protest something, but when we try to address the institutional racism that exists within our faith, it becomes a very different engagement piece, and nobody wants to talk about that because we're the good people, right? We're the good liberals that do all of the right things. It makes the work that folks try to do very disingenuous. You know, when I look over and I'm like, yeah, but I just saw you treating your Black congregants like crap. Like, why would I want to work with you? That's really where the credibility piece comes to play. Because if you're not doing work in your own congregation and your own faith, I don't really need you in my community because what are you going to do there? You haven't even cleaned up your own backyard and you're unwilling to even have a discussion around that. So that tells me you're not humble. It tells me you're not willing to actually do that internal work that really is at the heart of all the work that we do. And it's continual. You know, I was talking with somebody the other day. I continually am working myself. I say this thing where, like, when I feel myself bristle, I know that that's where my work is. You know, that's where I need to, like, lean into something. And it was something very innocuous. Like, there was some pushback from some trans folks about calling the Women's March a Women's March, you know, that was very centered in the gender binary. And I felt myself kind of bristle about, like, well, when do we get to center women? You know, how does that look? And it was, you know, I had a lot of, I called a bunch of people and started really talking about it with them. Like, why am I bristling about it? What is it that I'm missing? And I was missing something in the conversation, but it's really about being open to that and not assuming I know everything, not assuming that I am a fully formed individual and there's not additional work I need to do on myself to be less harmful to those that are around me. And that's really what we all, the place we all need to get to, is that moving that lower and lower, that harm that we do in the world, to be less and less and less.
I love that bristling as a wake up bell, like ding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. And both of you have shared profoundly about how you're willing to do that in different ways. So that feels like a lesson that everyone could take spiritually right now. Is when you feel yourself bristle, think of it as a door opening and look at what you don't see. So I was curious, Leslie Mack, you're doing the Safety Pin Project, which I know is different from Blue, But there are a lot of UU folks involved with it, it looks like. And I'm just
So many.
Is there anything you want to share about that?
It's been going really well. You know, Marissa and I have been working really hard. You know, it's been a challenge, you know, for both of us in this work to find a sustainable place that allows us to do good work, keep our sanity, to be perfectly honest. And so it's been refreshing to have this outlet for, you know, really unbelievable high quality content that really can make a difference. And we're already seeing some of the fruits of that. And then secondarily, obviously the financial gifts we've been able to give, you know, we're going into our second full month and we'll have given away over $10,000 directly to Black women. So it's been really, you know.
Oh, I just got goosebumps when you said that. That's so amazing.
So it's been super rewarding. You know, we picked our eight. Last month we had 5 recipients. This month we have 8. So as we grow, we get to give way more and more. We've added some other support to some independent Black media outlets because we take a lot of sustenance from them. So we're giving to them every month as well. So for Marissa and I, it's really about building in more ways to give back, more ways to interact with people. I think, you know, we're coming up on around 600 registrants. It's been a really quick ramp up. And so we're just trying to keep our heads above water while I'm doing all the other stuff that I do. It's been going really well.
Leslie, I have a question. Would it be feasible and or recommended that, like, one of the things I wanted to do is recommend that entire congregation subscribe, or is it genuinely geared towards individuals?
That's a very good question. It is currently geared towards individuals, but we are next month, February, end of February, we're going to be rolling out a group option because we've had a lot of requests for that. So we've had a lot of things come and just kind of people asking, and that's one of the things that's been pretty consistent, both congregational and then just general groups, people that meet, you know, once a week or once a month and they want to do work together. Be on the lookout for that. So it's coming. And I think that, you know, Marissa and I are both very involved in each of our individual faiths and in faith work, generally speaking. So I have a feeling in our conversations that there'll be something very specific for religious communities soon.
That's exciting. Well, is there anything we haven't asked about that you were hoping we would today? Anything?
Well, we did have a little bit of an announcement that we've had in addition to the Black Lives UU team, which is super exciting. And so Adam Dyer has joined the team officially, which is super exciting. We're overjoyed that he's come to gift us with his expertise and innovation and all that he brings to the table. And he's going to be kind of heading up the pastoral care side of things for Blue and has some incredible ideas about what that can look like. And we're just super excited. So that's a great, great new thing that just happened for all of us.
Well, that's fabulous. He's in Southern California, right?
He is, at least right now. I think he's in search. So who knows?
Yeah, okay. That's great. So do you all ever meet, or you're just planning all of this stuff remotely and then you'll be at the convening together?
Yeah. So we had our retreat. We do 2 a year. So we have fall and a spring. So we just finished our fall. And then the next time we'll all be together. Although somehow Lena and I have managed to be together at least once a month for the past 9 months or something. So we keep making sure that happens. I think it's,
I do think there is something to be said for being able to connect with people in person that you just can't do through all of our copious amounts of Zoom meetings or on the phone.
You know, I do so much of my work online, but those connections are pretty critical. And it's probably what's bringing me to DC. You know, so many people that I'll actually be in the room with again. And, you know, the convening was a good lesson in that, and the M4BL convening. And so for me, it's going to be something I try and work into.
Well, it's been lovely to be with y'all again. I hope that the weekend goes really well and we'll see you again before the convening. So that's good news. Any other parting words from anybody?
Pay Black women. That's all I have to say.
Yes, pay Black women. Amen.
Well, thanks very much, everybody. And we'll see you next week. Let's see. I'm trying to think who's here next week.
Judith
Frediani.
Time UUA. Religious educator, director, rock star.
She's going to talk about religious education, faith development, anti-racism, and all the ways that religious educators have really moved maybe ahead of the rest of the curve professionally around this stuff, which I'm excited about. As a religious educator, I'll just say, religious educators know stuff about community. That's really important. So that'll be fun. Good. Well, thanks again. Lovely to see you all. Take care.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.